Scott, the Western States preview is coming up, and what we learned is going to be hot. And if it's hot, you need electrolytes. You need some nutrition, Tailwind.
And some good tasting nutrition that you can eat all day long.
You know, a quick shake in the bottle and you're ready to go. One thing that has always impressed me is if it goes and shakes well in the bottle, you know what? You know where else it shakes well, Scott? In your belly.
That's a good point.
No gut bombs, no sticking. It just works.
So you can't overemphasize electrolytes when you're on a long, hot run like we're going to be talking about today.
Right.
How often are you taking supplemental like salt tabs or salt caps now?
You know, funny you mentioned that. It used to be standard packing procedures to make sure I had some sodium in a capsule form, and it hasn't. I've got my Tailwind and I'm good.
Are you confident that you don't need those capsules now?
Well, I'm confident I haven't used them, but like a good Boy Scout, Scott, I have backup, but I haven't needed it.
So Tailwind Nutrition, they have many tasty flavors. They have the new 2 caffeinated flavors that are very good. If you're running Western States, let's just put the buffet out there of Tailwind. Maybe you start with some lemon in the morning, kind of a little breakfasty, or some orange flavored, like you take orange juice. You get through the middle of the day, maybe you're having some berries, some berry flavored. When you get to Forest Hill, the sun starts coming down. That's when you jump into that raspberry buzz and the green tea buzz. Give yourself a little bit of caffeinated pick-me-up.
And then I recommend crossing the river naked, Scott. Go the naked flavor. That's the right way to go.
Cross the river naked. I wonder, maybe we should recommend to Jenny, maybe we need a dessert-flavored Tailwind for the last 5-10 miles of a 100-miler.
So go to Tailwind Nutrition, and don't be crazy like Scott and start eating dessert along the way.
Go to tailwindnutrition.com.
Back before the internet, Scott, the only real way you had to know the results of a race was waiting for Ultra Running Magazine to show up so you can go down and see what happened.
Now, Ultra Running Magazine is still a magazine that's out there, and it's more than just the finish numbers.
Yeah, yeah.
The finish results. There's great articles that can help each of us become better runners. I was just reading in the May-June issue. There's an article there that I have yet to read, but it caught my attention. It was talking about what Tim Tollefson talked about, one of his simple rules on one of the last podcasts about it's all in your hips, mm-hmm. and talks about how you can strengthen your glutes, how you can strengthen your hip flexors and make you a better runner. And that's one that I need to read.
Well, Scott, get on that. Get your Ultra Running Magazine. And if you haven't subscribed, go subscribe.
Yeah, it's that easy.
It is literally that easy. Go to Trail Runner Nation. That's us, right? And go to the partners page, click over, and you're standing in front of the vendor booth over at Ultra Running Magazine.
Put your credit card in and make the most valuable purchase that you can give to yourself this year.
Get faster. Go to Ultra Running Magazine.
Ladies and gentlemen of the worldwide Ultra Running community, you are listening to nothing less than the greatest Trail Running Nation podcast on earth. It is the Trail Runner Nation podcast.
This might be one of the most interesting podcasts ever.
Oh, that's what you're doing. There's a bunch of like old brothel hookers like buried out here.
No, I've listened to your podcast for many years, and it's
I do own my own bar. Every Friday morning on I Run Far, we open up and open up the taps.
You record this, aren't you, Freeman?
Get everything.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Trail Runner Nation. I'm Andy Jones Wilkins.
I'm Don Freeman,
and I'm Scott War, and we are just a few days away from Western States 100 2016,
which means it's time for a preview. And who better to get a preview from than the voice of the trail? I think AJW.
Oh, thanks, Don and Scott. It's great to be here finally in the actual Trail Runner Nation studio.
Sitting at the table, the East Coast executive producer taking that annual trek out for the conference that we hold each year.
Right.
And we have his partner right across the table right here. He's looking a little pale and thin.
You know, it is a skeleton sitting at the table, but I'll tell you that AJW is nearly as lean as a skeleton. You're looking hard rock ready.
Hard rock ready.
Well, Thanks. It's been a lot of work this this spring, but I'm just about ready, I think.
By looking at you, I can see that a lot of the pictures that you send about your workouts that are coming across in that Garmin are actually workouts. They're not like partially mountain bike rides and partially tripping the car to get the numbers up. These are real numbers. You're looking good.
Nope, I don't send the Garmin up in a helicopter.
get some elevation.
Right.
Hey, so let's kick it off. Is it what kind of year are you excited about this year's race? Is it every year is exciting, but what excites you about this year?
I think there's a lot of excitement going into this year's race around the domestic and international flavor of the of the top end of the field. A very, very competitive women's race, maybe the most competitive we've seen, and at least three fascinating age group stories.
Oh, good. I hope you're prepared to get into those.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Now Andy just rolled in. Yeah. I want to hear what he's been up to. I mean, he is training for Hard Rock. You told us a little bit. We held off. We told you to stop because we wanted to talk about it on the podcast, but Where did you roll in from today?
Well, fortunately for me, I've got a bit of time off from work, and I have a very forgiving family. So about a week ago, I flew out to Las Vegas and got a car and drove over to Silverton, Colorado, where I trained for 4.5 days with Brian Powell on the Hard Rock course. In fact, got up over Handy's Peak, the only 14,000-foot climb of the race. It goes over 13,000 feet 7 times, but over 14 once. And so we did that and had a couple of epic days, and I got a little bit used to the altitude. And then I jumped in the car and headed to Flagstaff, where I've just spent the last 2 days being a speaker and a counselor, if you will, at the Rob Krar Ultra Camp, which Rob's doing and his wife Christina for the second year in Flagstaff. They've got about 24 runners, and they have a group of speakers and special guests through the week, and I was the opening act yesterday. We did a nice 12-mile run in the foothills of the San Francisco Peaks, and then had a nice lunch and a talk, and then I hopped in the car and made it as far as the Kern River and camped along the Kern River last night, and now heading on up to Auburn after this and settling in for the rest of the week of Western States fun.
Fantastic. Now, Rob Krar's camp, open to others? Is it something that is going to be ongoing, and what can one look forward to do something like that?
Well, it's an amazing camp. He's, as I said, this is the second year he's done it. He's done it a little different time of year. The first time was after Western States. This year is before Western States, and he's not running Western States this year. But I think he caps it at 24 runners. He's got a staff of local people, remarkable food. They go to a different venue every day. Today they're in Sedona. They'll go to the Grand Canyon. They'll climb the Humphreys Peak, the tallest peak in Arizona. And all the while, Rob dispensing his wisdom and took him to see his strength workout and conditioning workout yesterday. So usually he comes up with the dates around December, January and gets the word out. And I strongly recommend it for people who are, especially if you're first getting into ultra running and you want to learn from the best. It's really, really outstanding. I hope to go back for many years because I really enjoy the camaraderie of the camp as well.
Mm-hmm. What about pre-qualifications? I mean, how good of a runner? You say for somebody getting into ultras, marathon shape,
Rob
5K
and
shape.
Rob and Mike and the staff are really good about all different abilities. So there was a runner there who's 3 weeks away from running Vermont 100, and then there are runners all the way back who are just getting ready for their first 50K. And he does a good job of screening the runners, and on most of the runs, as we did yesterday, you have a choice of distances, a choice of groups that who you'd like to go with. Throughout the week, the groups tend to pair up and triple up, and so it's all abilities, and it's remarkable they're able to pull it off, largely because Flagstaff has such a good running community.
Right.
Rob's able to staff the camp with guides, so every run has someone in the front, someone in the back, someone in the middle. It's great. It's a great way to spend a week.
There's a great nucleus of runners down there at Flagstaff, isn't there?
Absolutely. Yeah.
We've got our hot spots, you know, Colorado, Flagstaff. You got Bend, Oregon.
And
I like to include Auburn in this area, too.
I think you ought to include Auburn for sure.
So let's talk a little bit about 2016 and the course itself. Every year, starting about January, we start watching webcams to see the snowpack. And it's, I don't know if there's any other time that we watch as closely of what's happening up there, and is it going to be a heat year, a snow year? Is the course going to change? What do you see this year?
I'm thinking heat year.
Yeah.
There was a fair amount of snow this winter, though.
Yes.
And yet there weren't that many late snows. There'll probably be some patches under the trees and, mm-hmm. and so on in the high country. But I would imagine the runners will make pretty quick work of some of that. And it'll mostly be, it's even melting right now as we're having a little hot spell here. So it won't be a completely clear track, I don't think. But I think it'll predominantly be a clear track, and it's Craig's been able to announce that the water is low enough they'll be able to cross on foot mm-hmm. At the river crossing, and so that's always fun for people as well.
Didn't we talk to Sally just the other day, and she said the first 10 miles she thought were going to be in snow, but that and she just barely traveled that section. Yeah, probably three or four times. Well,
if you listen to that podcast, she wandered her way through retracing. So we don't know if she was actually on the trail or not, okay. But there is snow up there.
Yeah, so there's definitely some patches of snow, no doubt about it.
But the weather does look. I looked at the weather this morning, and it's going to be 100 plus in Auburn and Squaw. So that means those canyons are going to be cooking.
I mean, the 30-year average for Auburn is 90, 91 this day. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be a good 10 degrees above that. And what's interesting, if you're a weather, Western States weather geek like I am, Monday, Tuesday are supposed to be 105, 106. If that backs up a little bit, if the mm-hmm. high pressure builds sooner, we could see a hotter day than 100. That happened in 2013 when going into the race, right. We thought it might be 98, 99. It was 105.
Yeah, I remember. That's the year I ran it. Well, that's the year I traveled Western States. I don't know if I ran much of that one. That was an awful experience, but still wonderful. So let's make a commitment before we get off on this particular podcast. There's a lot of focus that we do on Western States. That's kind of where we're located. But let's commit to doing something East Coast later on in the year when something big's coming up mm-hmm. or something in Europe. Let's focus on another race too besides Western States to be fair for the other listeners out there.
I'd like to do that. That'd be great.
Awesome. So June 17th, 2016, hot days at Western States. You wrote an article at I Run Far and gave some just tips about hot weather running. Let's start with that since it's kind of a focus of a hot year and we all get around the sun at some point. What are mm-hmm. What are a couple of tips you have for hot weather runners?
Well, I had a real sort of simple practical one, which is the ice bandana.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a huge fan of that. My wife Shelley makes them and just sews up a couple of the lines and has some holes to put the ice in, and starting around dusty corners or sometimes even Robinson Flat, just stuff it with ice. Usually get two and just switch them out with your crew. Just have that around your neck all through the heat of the day, water dripping everywhere. It's just nice. And related to that, soak. Stay as wet as you can for as long as you can. You know, mm-hmm. you cross 30, 35 creeks in the course of Western States 100, some huge like the American River, some tiny little trickle. Throw your bandana down there, take your shirt off, toss it in, get yourself wet, and try and stay wet as long as possible. That 30 seconds you might spend getting yourself cooled off will make a big, big, big difference. And I'll give you some key spots if you're running the race. There are two in particular. After you cross the Swinging Bridge, mile 45, you make a left-hand turn, you have a flat for about 100 yards, and there's a spring mm-hmm. coming right out of there. You can drink out of that spring, but you can also get soaked under that, splash yourself, and it's right before the heinous climb up to Devil's Thumb. It's a great time to be wet. The next one's Volcano Canyon, the third of the three canyons, the one that's often overlooked out of the grandeur of El Dorado and Deadwood. But in Volcano, if you cross on foot just a little ways upstream, there's usually enough water where you can do a complete submersion.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get yourself completely wet, go for a little swim, do it in a minute, and be up that, and you're still wet by the time you get to the bottom of Bath Road.
You sacrifice a minute, but you pick up a great deal. Your body mm-hmm. picks up, and there's still a lot of racing left.
There's also that mental euphoria of, oh, that feels good.
Yeah, cooling things
just
down.
Just that notion of feeling good.
Well, and also to get the dust of the trail off. Mm-hmm. I mean, that does amazing things mentally to just be able to refresh yourself and almost restart or reboot.
Yeah, and even if the good feeling, even if you're dirty again in 5 minutes, the fact that you were clean for 5 minutes is like 5 minutes I was clean.
So one of the things I imagine a lot of new runners like myself years ago is they're worried about getting their feet wet and getting their shoes wet. How does that play into jumping in the river? I mean, do you need to worry about that?
Well, you're going to have wet feet at Western States, even in a non-snow year. So here, with it all melting dramatically, once you're over the escarpment and into the Granite Chief Wilderness, several sections of the trail, you're basically just running through, you know, melting snow and creeks and just slush, and your feet are wet and muddy all the way pretty much to Duncan Canyon, mile 23. And then when you drop into Duncan Canyon, you cross Duncan Creek, and it's only a rare year that you're not wet crossing Duncan Creek. So you have to get used to running in wet feet. Depending on how your feet respond to being wet, you can change socks, you can change shoes. I mean, I know there are runners who do that. There are runners who would swear to never do that. I think that's a personal thing to experiment with. Probably a little bit too late to experiment with it now, but I certainly wouldn't put it past anybody to throw a couple extra pairs of shoes and socks in a drop bag or have them along with your crew. And if something just doesn't feel right, switch them out. And sometimes nothing like those clean pair of socks.
Oh yeah.
Have either of you ever tried the Gore-Tex versions of trail shoes?
I have not.
I haven't either. I kind of think of them as bathtubs.
Yeah.
And so I've never tried. I'm just curious. Have you tried them,
Yeah,
Bob?
You know, I think I experienced a nothing in, but nothing comes out either. And any time water came up over the top, it just kind of
sat there.
Yeah. You know, shoes today, for trail shoes, I think one of their primary prerequisites is
drainage.
Yeah. You know, in and out pretty quick. And you match that with a good sock. I think you're mm-hmm. you've got the right recipe.
Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned also in that heat article how to protect yourself against the catastrophe of heat is you can end up with some chafing if you're not careful. If you're mm-hmm. always carrying the water and things are dripping, so that's a good thing to protect yourself with the other Glide or the cream butter or whatever you're going to put around the areas that are chafing. You know,
yeah,
prepare for that.
I think it's really important to start fully lubed.
Yeah,
and then. As early as mile 17, you could have a drop bag at Red Star, maybe have a tube of lube in there. And then every time you see your crew, whether you have one or two crews, just be ready to lube up again.
It just makes sense because there's nothing worse than chafing to really kind of get you down. And it's those little nagging things that start to work on your happy spot, your brain, when you're trying to finish these things. And you just don't need those hot spots.
No.
And some come in the worst of places and you don't need that.
Right.
Yeah. All right. Anything else on heat? Are we ready to move on and talk about the race?
I have one other piece, and that's as runners are evaluating their expectations on race day.
Oh, that's a great one. That's a really good one.
Because all of us have looked at, you know, splits from past races, and hey, I'm as fast as that guy, maybe, and he did 22 hours. Maybe I can do 22 hours too. And I think there comes a time in the race when you know it's going to be a certain heat kind of day where you have to just throw those splits out the window. And whether that means your dream of a silver buckle goes out the window or not really doesn't matter because you want to finish. And, you know, there have been some legendary years at Western States where people, if they've just finished at all, they have a badge of honor. 2006 is one such year. And so you've got to be prepared to, if you have in your brain 24 hours and the day brings you something else, be ready for that something else and roll on through.
Did you run 2006?
I did.
So time out. You ran 2005 as well,
yeah.
Correct? So let's talk about 2005, which was a moderate year as far as heat goes. I was able to run that year and it was pleasant. But 2016, I was able to crew. It was not pleasant even to crew. It was hot. What were your time differences? Because I would imagine pretty close to the same fitness level, age level stuff. What were the differences between?
Just under 3 hours difference.
Wow.
I ran 17:07 in 2005, and I ran 20:04 in 2006. Now, caveat, that was the year they returned to Duncan Canyon. The Star Fire had closed Duncan Canyon for 4 years, and so we ran from Red Star Ridge to Robinson Flat and then did a loop around Little Bald Mountain in 04 and 05. Went back, and it was rugged and burned out and exposed in 2006. But it was 115 degrees in El Dorado, and the kicker on 2006 was it heated up the whole week before.
Yeah.
It was in the hundreds.
It doesn't cool down.
And it just stayed, and those canyon walls just baked and baked and baked. And so you had the, you know, I joke about it, it was like running on a pizza stone because the heat is coming up as well as coming down on you. Even though 2013 was hotter in Auburn, I think it's conventional wisdom that 2006 was way worse.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, that's nice to keep in perspective that even a person that compares 1 year to the next 3 hours, you do need to throw your splits out the window mm-hmm. because you can't fight that.
You know, I one of the things that I've found very, very interesting is even in those really hot years, the top five guys maybe don't see that big of a difference. Is that true, or is that just my imagination? You know, let's take a moderate year versus a hot year. Those podium finishers, it seems to me that they're not as affected by the heat as much as
they're not in it as long as we are.
Yeah, right.
So let's just start there.
That's well,
true.
I think
15 hours versus 30.
I think you did see that. You did see that with Rob Krar in 2013, which was a notoriously hot year, and he wasn't all that affected by it. Nor was Seth Swanson, who finished second. I think what you did see is more attrition and a wider spread from, say, first place to 10th place.
Okay.
You know, and one of the more benign years in my running of tenure at Western States was 2011. Mm-hmm. And the distance between first place and 10th place was, I don't know, a little bit more than an hour. You know, and you had going as deep as 14th, 15th place, men finishing under 17 hours, which is a remarkable good day for people with very few dropouts. I think this year we're going to see a few more dropouts. Mm-hmm. I think that's just the data seems to suggest any year we have 100-plus in Auburn, 110, 115 in El Dorado, you're just going to have a little bit bigger attrition. How much is it going to be? I don't know, but I would guess that it'll be a greater than two-hour difference between the men's winner and the 10th place runner for the men, and probably 2.5 to 3 hours difference between the women's winner and the 10th place runner. Hmm. So it's a good year to try and snag a top 10, I think, if you're smart. You play your cards close to the vest. You really wait till Forest Hill to let it roll. And then after the river, when it finally cools off, you let it rip.
Yeah, good.
I wish I was in the race.
I can hear it. I can hear it. And you're ready for Hard Rock, so you could get out there and have a good swing at it this year. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I got to admit, and I'm this is by no means a suggestion that I would be in this race to win it by any stretch, because I wouldn't be. But it's an interesting dynamic that last year the top 10 men, the top four from last year aren't back for various reasons, but they're not back. And so just by virtue of experienced runners, there's fewer of them. You know, on the women's side, 8 of the top 10 from last year are back.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a fair amount of intrigue around both races in that regard.
Good. Let's get it.
Why do you suppose, I know you probably know some of the reasons, but overall, Why is that in the men's field? Is it just because there's so many other great races out there? And
I know firsthand only two stories, and that's Rob, who pretty much decided the day he finished last year that 3 years in a row was enough for him, and he was ready to take a break. Now, spending some time with him this past week, he looks forward to coming back to Western States. It's in his blood, and he loves it, but he felt like he needed a break after 3 years. Seth Swanson was prepared to run, and he's got an injury. And I'm not sure the magnitude of the injury, but, you know, when you were second place the previous year and the winner's not coming back, there's a fair amount of pressure and expectation. Sure. You want to bring your A game. So I'm sure there are reasons for all of the DNSs in that top four, but it does seem to create a little bit of a sense of kind of wide open field to it. On the women's side, while there's more of that top 10 from last year, you know, the women were clustered close together in one through 8 and 9, and you know, you could snag a top 10 with a smart race. Mm. I think the smartest race last year on the women's side was Erica Lindland, who many of you probably, both of you probably
Ultra
know.
Magazine.
I mean, right. She got to, this is a little geeky, but she got to Robinson Flat in 6:37, which more or less is like 24-hour, or maybe just a little bit under 24-hour. And by the time she got to the river, she was in 16th, and she closed and got a top 10.
Wow.
And did it, you know, very, very measured, and took advantage of sweeping up the, you know, the carnage that was out there on a hot day. And so I could see that happening again. Now, the women's field's a little bit more competitive. I wouldn't advise a runner to, you know, to shoot for a 6:45 and expect a whole lot of runners to come back. But I could see runners over 6:15, 6:20 getting to Robinson Flat and having a run. This is on the women's side, having a run at the top 10.
Good. Let's get into that very race. Now, Andy Jones-Wilkins, as you probably know, writes at the for I Run Far from the tap room, directly from the bar itself, correct?
From the bar. Yeah.
Behind the tap, at the tap room. And you've finished Western States 10 times, correct? So we have some course knowledge to bring to part of the forecasting here.
And self-proclaimed Western States geek.
Yeah,
he geeks out.
Guilty as charged.
No argument from me. So let's start off with the women's side. Ladies first, what do you see?
Well, what I've kind of clustered the sort of contenders into two groups, kind of a lead pack where I think the winner is likely to come from,
okay,
of four, and then a kind of a chase pack of five where I think you could see some surprises. You could see some opportunistic runners who might want to sweep up some carnage. And I've intentionally saved that 10th spot because there's somebody out there that I'm not going to talk about that is probably going to get top 10.
Yeah. I like how you broke it.
Are you saying you know who that person is?
I have no idea who that person is.
Okay, so you're saying you don't know, but you think there's going to be a surprise.
There's somebody with a high number who may be under or below any radar. Yeah. Who will find a way into that top 10. It seems to happen every year.
Yeah, that's
but at the front of the pack, I have to go with Magdalena Boulay and Casey Lichtig as the two runners who are, I mean, I would have to imagine there's a pretty good chance the winner is going to come from one of the two of them. Magda, in her debut last year, just over 19 hours, has the pedigree of a marathoner, has been training really hard. Casey has methodically gone from sixth place to second place. She was closing last year. I think if it had been a 110-mile race, they might have been real close.
Uh-huh.
So I think out of those two, we'll see an interesting front pack. Whether they'll go off the front or not together remains to be seen. But I'd say that there's a good chance that those two will be in the hunt. Yiyao Wang, who has taken the ultra running world by storm a little bit on the women's side with a win, a dominating win at Lake Sonoma. Completely inexperienced beyond 50 miles, but insane fast, and may not even know how fast she is. And on the other side of that, very, very experienced and steady as she goes, Eliza LaPierre from Vermont.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you've got Casey and Magda up here, and then, you know, both experienced, both Western States veterans, a winner and a second place, then you've got this huge disparity of Yiyao. You have no idea what she's going to do. And you got Eliza, who's almost become kind of the female version of Ian Sharman. You could kind of write down a top 10 for her right now, and
right,
she'll probably do it.
Yeah.
So I think that'll be an interesting first four, and the winner, you know, I give it a better than 50% chance a winner comes from there. But in a hot year with all kinds of variables.
Let me ask that question about the hot year. Of those front four in the first pack, is there anybody that is more inclined to perform well in heat? Do you have any experience with that?
I'm assuming all four are doing their heat training.
Yeah.
You know, I haven't seen enough of Yiyao to know what, if any, performance she can do in the heat. I know all the other three have, you know, been able to run in the heat.
And
Casey's from Omaha, Nebraska, from Nebraska. And I mean, she deals with the heat. Eliza's from Vermont, but she gets around. You know, she had a great run here in Miwok on a relatively warm day. So,
and she's just tough.
They're going to do their,
and
oh,
smart.
She's tough and smart.
Yeah. And it's fun to watch somebody that has only run 50 miles take on the bigger distance and watch how they handle it or how do they, what strategy they come in with, because there's there's a lot of different things that happen in the sixth in your sixth set of 10 or 7 miles, 70 and 80 and 90.
That's where a lot happens.
Yeah. And you know, even going into Western States, there's so much information that's out there on the internet and from coaches that you could go in you could go in with an exact game plan of how to execute on a hot deer like this year.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so you don't, there's a point where you have to experience it, but there's also the other side where if you just listen to all the information from the years of Western States being around, I think that you could still have a very good
day. Mm-hmm. So if I look at the chase pack of five, I see one of last year's top teners kind of at the front of that chase pack, and that's Sally McCray.
Mm-hmm.
She will have no problem with the heat. And I think she will be ready to work. And I think she's going to probably push things a little bit. And then four golden ticket runners. So four runners who've come in via races earlier in the spring. And these are in no particular order, but out of the Northwest, Jody Adams-Moore. Mm-hmm. From the East Coast, Bethany Patterson from Virginia. Up in Oregon, Amy Sproston, three-time finisher, all in the mid-19s. And Devin Yanko from the Bay Area, who's had a few years away, but had an incredible Javelina 100 in October.
In American River 50.
And American River 50.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, there's some pedigree in that group right there, with the exception of Jody Adams-Moore, who hasn't run 100. The other four have 100-mile experience. They have short distance, middle distance, long distance experience. They all know how to win. All five of those women have won races. Mm-hmm. They all run pretty smart. And I mean, if I'm in that front four pack, this is part of why. I mean, if I was in the women's field in the hunt for the top 10, I'd be like, wow, there's not much margin for error.
Right. Right.
Now, in a hot year, you know, if you could be, let's say you're Jody, and you've not run one before, you're Bethany, you haven't been to Western States since 2004, you might want to hang back, you know, and be 12th or 13th at Michigan Bluff and see, or, you know, maybe in time, if you're less than 45 minutes off of Casey and Magda, I wouldn't be worried. But I think you're going to have a really, really interesting second half with a chase pack like that.
It makes for an interesting watching the race, knowing that these are the packs, and your predictions are probably very, very accurate based on your analysis of watching these things actually take place, mm-hmm. you know, and watching how they position themselves and when one breaks away making sure you stick with that group so it doesn't get out of reach.
You know, I'm just going to throw in, because we'll probably do this at the end of the podcast. We'll do it in the show notes too, but this is one of those races that you can actually watch unfold on many different media mm-hmm. outlets. Mm-hmm. I Run Far is going to be out there. They're out at a lot of races where they're tweeting updates. You can watch it live on Ultra Live TV. Western States, do they have something separate or than Ultra Live TV?
Well, they ultralive.net.
Ultralive.net
will have the full results, and you can look up runners and so forth just by number and all. But I Run Far will have, you know, the front end of the field if you're looking to see the top 10 or 12 or 15 at any given time. And then from there, there's all kinds of venues. I mean, I'm going to be out there. But I'll probably be doing a little bit more goofy stuff.
I mean, that's the fun part yeah. about a big race like this, is because you can participate as a spectator and kind of watch things unfold.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Let's talk about on Brian Powell's list, on his predictive list. He had a top 10 finisher for 8 straight Western States. You know her well. She runs in this local area, Megan Arbogast. Just a fantastic competitor. Talk a little bit about her consistency and what makes her just the runner that she is.
Well, Megan was one in my age group stories to watch,
I'm sorry
too.
About that.
But I think Megan could surprise, especially if it's real hot. Megan could surprise and sneak into that top 10. Anybody who wavers, you know, Megan will be right there. She got 12th last year. I think she was the unfortunate recipient of Nikki Kimball going for her 10th finish, all in top 10.
Yeah.
And then a real surprise performance out of an East Coaster, Robin Watkins, who came from 30th place at Robinson Flat and ended up in 11th and passed Megan, I think, somewhere between Browns Bar and Highway 49. Megan will be prepared. Megan will have a smile on her face the whole time. Megan will be smart in the high country, not overexert herself in altitude. She's probably been up there a fair amount training. And she'll finish and get that 10-day, 1,000-mile buckle.
Yeah, that's a special one there.
Mm-hmm.
Good. Any? I'm sorry to take away from your age group story there.
No, not at all.
Good.
I think she's it wasn't very long ago. You recall that one of the most iconic age group records that's still on the books, Doug Latimer's 1843 from 1988. Megan was 6 minutes away from that record. That's a woman getting the 50-year and older record. She missed it, but she was about as close as anybody's been. And has all the age group records, of course, from 40s and 50s.
So inspiring to be so competitive, so strong right. in the fifth decade, right? There's many people that are that just have retired from any activity in life. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking runners. I mean, just people that you see down at the store, they're done. And
well, I gotta say, I'm going to switch gears before we go to the men. And the even more compelling age group story is Mark Rickman on the men's side, over 60 years old. Had the distinct honor, I believe it was in 2004 or maybe even 2003, of finishing Western States in 1759-59.
Wow.
And he looked at his watch once at Michigan Bluff. Well, he's back. He's hit these age group records at the 50K on the track and 50 miles, and he's done his homework. And Roger Delaware's over 60 record is in serious danger. With Mark Rickman in the
field. What is
and,
that time?
I believe it's 21-22, but don't quote me on that. It's somewhere in the low 20s.
It's in jeopardy is what you're saying.
I think I'd be shocked if Rickman didn't get it. It'd have to be a really insanely hot day for Mark not to get that record.
Yeah. And but you can never, on a 100-mile distance, you can never predict anything. Anything could happen. I mean, your stomach could go south, and it never goes south. You can end up with a blister that you've never seen before. There's just things that happen, and that's why we line up and race them. You know, that's what makes them so interesting.
You want to go into the age group for the women, or you want to go to the men first and then
let's
do age group
AJW
later?
AJW lead us.
Yeah, let's go over to the men, if
okay.
you don't mind.
Because
yeah, I think it's a little bit more intriguing in that it's not, I don't think it's as packed at the top end, but it also has some really interesting stories. Number one is the international runners and the domestic runners. In my group of four at the top, I've got Francois Dehaene, who ran with Rob Krar through Michigan Bluff last year before wavering and ending up dropping out. He probably has a little fire in the belly.
Mm-hmm.
And Thomas Lourblanchette, a former Leadville winner. Who's been training real hard and I think has a real good shot at running up at the pointy end of the field. Last year's Ultra Running Magazine Runner of the Year, David Laney, would certainly have to be on most people's list of potential to win this thing. And a guy who's been around but has yet to finish 100, he did attempt UTMB and had an unfortunate fall and a messed up leg, Sage Cannaday. Mm. So I'd put those guys in my group of four, similar to, you know, Casey and Magda and the like, out of their pedigree, their experience, what I've seen of their training. But the chase pack there is all over the place. Jim Walmsley, who's on fire from Flagstaff, Arizona,
right?
Lake Sonoma course record, got his golden ticket spot at Bandera 100K. Two other Europeans, Diederik Hermansen, no idea how he's going to do coming from the North Country in Scandinavia, but has some incredible times. And Toffel Castanier, first time here at Western States. So we're seeing in those international runners, by the way, the impact of the Ultra Trail World Tour and the fact that we are able to assemble a field at Western States made up of both international runners, highly successful on the World Tour, and our domestic runners who are able to perform at a very high level in our golden ticket races. And then two domestic runners, one a British citizen, one an American citizen, that are just amazing stories. Ian Sharman, who will be going for his seventh consecutive top 10.
Mr. Consistency.
Consistency. And a guy who has won a bunch of 100-milers and had bad luck in the lottery and is finally coming back to get it right, I think, and that's Jeff Browning from Bend, Oregon. And so I think Jeff Browning, I can assure you, from Forest Hill in, will pass a bunch of people. Mm-hmm. I don't know what place that means he'll end up in, but he is about as masterful a carnage sweeper as there is out there.
Masterful carnage sweeper.
Yeah.
I need to write that one down.
MCS. Oh, that's and he does run smart in the beginning to make sure that he can sweep up the carnage. And for anybody that's ever passed anyone, even if it's been one person in a race, it gives you a little bit of energy. Mm-hmm. You capture a little bit because you don't feel necessarily good that you've defeated someone as much as, hey, maybe I did something right. It's just, it gives you some confidence that I executed. Yes, that's good. And so, but beware, that person that you pass may come up behind you again and pass you. So there's some nice trading off that does occur. So Chris DiNucci, he did very well, and he's racing this year. Mm-hmm. He won American River 50 very fast and a talented runner. So there's another name to watch mm-hmm. that's out here. Anybody else on your list or your second group of pack?
That's it. Mm. Well, there's going to be a surprise, right? There's nine, so there's still a spot for someone if they want that 10th spot. But I think it'll be interesting. If I could make up the list again at Michigan Bluff,
maybe you should be tweeting
almost like, you know how some people in their NCAA office pools, they do the 64 and the 32, and then they re-rank when they get to the 16. It'd be really cool to see, like, of these 18 runners, the nine men and the nine women, how many are still standing at Michigan Bluff? And even if they're standing, how many of them are in survival mode versus race mode? And I think I'll be interested, and I'll kind of keep track of it, but I think I'll be interested to see how this year's conditions on the course in particular, as it relates to the heat, but also the fire going through the Deadwood Canyon area, the exposure there, Pucker Point, and so forth. You know, that hasn't matured all that much. It's still going to be hot and exposed, and how that eats away at people. You know, I'm going to hazard a guess that of my nine men, you know, there'll probably be six standing, and of my nine women, they'll probably be seven. I think the women will be a little bit more, practice a little bit more self-preservation this year than the men. And they usually do.
And so a Michigan Bluff mile 55, mm-hmm. Forest Hill, which is your next aid station, mile 62. It's interesting to watch the shape of the runners come through there. What kind of mm-hmm. physical makeup are they at that point? You know, are they staying a long time at an aid station? Are they getting some work done to a leg or you know, what's happening with them? So it's a nice preview of what's next mm-hmm. in that race. Like you said, it'd be nice to remake the list at that point because you learn a lot mm-hmm. in that first 62 miles.
You learn a ton.
It's a big filter.
Yeah.
So good. Any other any predictions? You have the story of the year, maybe the story of the race with Gunhild Swanson.
Yeah, so I'd like to, a couple intriguing stories. Gunhild Swanson finished with 6 seconds to spare last year, Spokane, Washington, got picked in the lottery this year and is back and has trained hard and is promising all of us that she'll not keep us in such suspense this year. I'm also thrilled and honored that Gunhild will join me and the veterans panel on Thursday night. If listeners out there, if you're in Squaw Valley on Thursday night at 5 o'clock, we'll have a nice panel with Gunhild and Erica Lindland and Ian Sharman, who we've mm-hmm. talked about.
You got
already.
Erica to be on the panel? Mm-hmm.
And Danny wow. Danny Westergaard. I have 100% people accepting my invitations. I don't know what it is, but yeah, I got them all on there.
Well, they know that you talk a lot, so it really means they just get the best seat in the house.
Maybe that's why Erica said yes, because I've tried to get her to do some pre-race stuff, and she's a very shy person.
She's focused on a race, Scott.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I'm thrilled to have her on the panel, and I think she'll be an interesting companion to Gunhild on the women's mm-hmm. side, and then Ian and Danny. Danny Westergaard's an interesting story. He's going for number 10, and I think of all nine, only one is a silver. So he's been out there on the trail a long mm-hmm. time.
Yeah, yeah.
And that'll be interesting. But in addition to Gunhild, you know, there were three other septuagenarians on the start list, but Gary Nippling, who's a Virginia runner who I know very well, suffered a stroke about 2 months ago. And while he's expected to make a full recovery and is now running a fair amount, he's not able to run enough to come out here and run Western States. But Wally Heseltine, of you may have heard
yeah,
of,
yeah.
who's 72 years old and has done some amazing things at Angeles Crest and other things, and Rod Dixon are two other septuagenarians who will be towing the line in Squaw. So, I mean, they're pushing the envelope of age, we're really seeing happen, whether it's in the 70-year-olds, a Rickman in the 60s, Megan in the 50s. I mean, that could end up being an interesting subplot to this whole race this year, is how aging and ultra running are coalescing, because there's so much, of course, that we hear as ultra runners. Oh my gosh, what does that do to your knees? You're going to die. You're going to burn out. You're going to overtrain. And certainly people do all those things. But we're seeing, at least in this year's race, a certain amount of excitement around the older folks.
Well, you look at the people that have had knee replacements, generally they're not runners or cyclists or hikers or people out there using their body. The, you know, the body has the ability to adapt and become stronger in areas that you're using. It's the sedentary people that try to get up off the couch and twist their leg as they're getting up mm-hmm. that all of a sudden tear something and there they go. They're at knee replacement. So it's I don't think we wear our body parts out. I think we let them go to waste by not using them. So it's fun to see people just pushing, like you said, the age envelope and redefining.
I've learned if you wear them out, there are some doctors who can fix them.
Yeah,
and a great story, by the way.
Yeah, let's talk about your story.
How many months post surgery are you right now?
It was 9 months ago today. Actually, it was September 21st, the fall equinox, down in South Carolina, hip resurfacing surgery, which is not the same as total hip replacement. And I went into the doctor, Dr. Thomas Gross, totally opened, transparent. I said, look, I want to run this race in Colorado. And I mm-hmm. showed him the pictures of it. And he's like, oh yeah, you'll be able to do that. Now, I'm not sure if he thought I'd be able to do it in 9 months or nine and what'll end up being a little bit less than 10 months. But it
did,
it
did
was
you
something.
Say I want to do it in 2016 and yeah. he said yes or did he
no
thinking.
I didn't include the date.
Always a wise negotiator.
Yeah.
Leave out the details,
but I've honestly felt like and I'm you know, surgery is, everyone reacts to surgery differently and recovering from surgery, but I have never felt as alive as I have in this recovery. When I finally realized that I was going to be able to be a runner again, you know, not a 17-hour Western States runner by any means, but a runner who could run 100 miles, or a runner who could train for 4 days in Silverton and climb 14,000-foot peaks. Mm. When I realized that, it was as if my soul was reawakened.
Wow.
And the rest of my life took shape around that. My job, my family, my relationships with my parents and my friends and so forth. And so I'm coming into this Western States, you know, as a coach and a observer of the race and a person who loves the event like no other. But I also have to say, in the back of my mind, my heart's all over there in Silverton, you know, where in 24 days I'll be testing myself against one of the most amazing mountain ranges in the country. And the fact that I can do that when it was, you know, 9 months ago, I was on that operating table and my hip was dislocated and there was blood everywhere and I had, you know, titanium put into my body.
Even 10, 12 months, you know, where you're running in pain and thinking, I'm not going to be able to do this very much longer.
And you know, and now the pain is normal pain, like sore quads and tight hip flexors and plantar fasciitis. And man, I'm never going to whine out about any of those again.
And that's my question to you about how do you now, second chance out there again, what's training like for you now versus then? And not so much pain in the body, but just the overall experience. When it gets hard, is it hard, or you accept it more and enjoy the adversity more? If that makes sense, is there a question there?
I think I know what you're getting at, and there is a question. I think it's more satisfying to train hard and work toward a goal when you, a short time earlier, were wondering if you'd ever be able to do it again.
Yeah.
And that's why, I mean, you guys commented, I have lost, I'm probably lighter than I was as a sophomore in high school.
Yeah, you're lean.
My best Western States, I weighed 4 pounds more than I weigh now. Mm-hmm. I mean, so I've worked hard. Mm-hmm. I've taken it seriously. I've taken care of myself. I'm not so self-absorbed in time in a time goal or in a place goal, but it's about having a satisfying life, and running gives me a satisfying life and makes me a whole person. And that's what I've realized in this buildup, and coming back from the surgery. And running really is not only what I do, but who I am. So I'll take a good long time off when Hard Rock's over.
and there's a finality to it for all of us. We know we can't run forever. And to that point, on the days that we're trying to decide, should we or shouldn't we go out for a run that day? The answer should, if you're swaying, it's not because you're overtraining, just because are you inconvenienced, should always be get out there and run, because one day you won't have that choice to say yes or no. So we need to stay on the trail while we can.
And well, I want to, we had that a couple months ago, and I think I, we talked about overtraining, and I want to, I think I was a little, you got me at a moment where I was really on the ramp going up, and I felt a little bit invincible and, you know, kind of brashly saying, I'm not going to ever overtrain, or, you know, mid packers and back of the packers don't overtrain. And I've thought a lot about that, and it's not really true. I mean, it was a brash guy coming back from surgery, feeling like he was on top of the world. I think what I would temper that comment with is saying, you know, you, when something like this happens to you, you pay more attention. And when you've been running ultras for 20 years, you tend to know the warning signs, and whether you ignore them or not is, you know, that's your deal, but you tend to know the warning signs, and that's what you can share with other people who might be doing it for 2 years or 5 years or 10 years.
Right. No, and I took that from your comment at the time. I didn't think that you were over the top invincible superhero. Although I've seen your times and tried to chase you on a particular trail. Always my favorite story, running the first 6 miles from Forest Hill back to Michigan, 62 to 55 on a training run, and felt pretty good about myself keeping up with Andy, but realizing he really was just warming up. And I was on my speed day.
And then all the speed workout.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden, down Michigan he goes, and he says, I'm just going to stretch out here a bit. And he, within two turns, gone. And then three turns, dust settled. I mean, it was incredible. I realized, you know what, there's two different animals here. We have a pack mule and a quarter horse.
Well, that's one of the best downhills in ultra running.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Yeah.
You know, I like what you said, and you kind of expounded on a little bit, but I want to get back to it, that once you realize that you could, again, be the runner who you wanted to be, that professionally, things kind of came in line with your family, came in line. Can you expound a little bit on that and how that whole thing, how running helps make the circle complete?
Yeah, I can, because I've thought a lot about it. I think as I was spiraling into really chronic pain and chronic injury, I was losing. I was losing confidence, but I was also losing hope, and starting to think about, well, what, am I going to start racing bikes, or am I going to, you know, be a swimmer, or is this finally the time that I take up some other, you know, maybe I write the book that I've always wanted to write and not had the time to because I've been training. And hope, being able to hope, is a skill, I think. I mean, in a spiritual sense, you want to have hope that there's something greater, that there's something larger than yourself. But you also have to, hopeful people are optimistic. They're glass half full. They believe that there's something better. They may not know what it is or how to get there, but they still know that it's there. And when you lose it, right, the opposite is despair.
Right.
And I have to admit, in a general sense, I'm a somewhat melancholy person. I fight that melancholy by being more upbeat and happy and surrounding myself with people who are upbeat and happy. But when you start to lose that sense of hope, a lot of other things can crumble. And what this experience taught me, going from the day of that surgery to my comeback to where I am now, you know, 24 days away from Hard Rock, and here for Western States and going to be enjoying the whole pomp and circumstance of the whole thing, I'm a hopeful guy again. And I don't want to lose that again. Even if I end up having to get my other hip done, even if I have to just run 10 miles a day or 5 miles a day at some point, that's what I don't want to lose again. Although I did have a friend on Facebook say, Jeff Kozak, dear, dear friend, he quoted the Sawchuck 7 because there was Brian Powell posted a picture of me in Silverton, and Kozak said, wow, you look bleeping fit. Are you going to try and do another Sawchuck 7 for Hard Rock? I was like, I don't think you can do two Sawchuck 7s. But
I'm glad we've helped coin the
Sawchuck 7. Yeah.
I wonder if he knows about this new coinage. Well, that's good. I'm excited to see what happens this weekend. I'd like to just bring up, because I'm reading it about it right now, Jeff Browning is also running Hard Rock.
He is.
So how do you, as an athlete, have another big race, and whether we're talking about Jeff's Western States and Hard Rock, or back in the day when Scott Jurek did
Badwater
right after. I mean, how do you manage?
Yeah, it's interesting. The story of Jeff is interesting because he had spent several years trying to get into Western States through the normal means of the lottery and so on and so forth. He's a 100-mile guy, so he knows he knew he's not the kind of guy who could bust out of Lake Sonoma top two and get in. You know, he's a 100-miler. So lo and behold, the 1 year he gets into Western States, a day later his name gets pulled for Hard Rock.
Oh.
You know, it's almost Murphy's Law. So I haven't talked to him. I think Brian Powell and Megan are probably going to talk to him later this week. My guess is he'll go from the gun at Western States.
Yeah.
He's got the chops to get through Hard Rock regardless. But as somebody who's done that double, I did that double in 2009. Oh, man, it's brutal.
Yeah.
You know, and as soon as you get to the track and you get showered, you're like, oh, my gosh, and now I have to go to Silverton at 9,300 feet and get ready. So, but on the flip side, when I look back on that summer, it was like the summer of a lifetime. So I think it could be an interesting story when all's said and done, when Jeff Browning kisses that rock on July 16th, how it all went down for him.
But you have to race that first race.
You just have to
go from the gun.
And it's Western States.
Yeah. Well,
You're not going to come and run Western States as a training run.
No, that should not be your B race, right?
No.
Ever. Okay. Hey, well, that's good. You'll be on the microphone a bit at Western States this year?
I will, and I want to mention something. So I'll be on the mic from 24 to 26 hours, but I want to also, if you don't mind, bring up what I think is the story of this year's Western States, and that's the return of Brian Morrison.
Mm-hmm.
10 years ago this week, Brian was in lead at Western States and got to the Placer High School track and collapsed and made it around the track, but not under his own power, and was disqualified, or technically was credited with a did not finish at Roby Point. And Brian has had lots of water under the bridge over the last 10 years. He came back to Western States the last year. The next year, dropped out at Dusty Corners, got out of the sport for a little while, started a family. And last August, got a qualifier at Cascade Crest 100 and applied for the lottery, didn't get in, and was the one Western States Board special consideration entrant into the race this year, which warms my heart to know that a decade after that, what was by all accounts just a horrible thing to witness. Craig Thornley, who's now the race director, that was one of the years he didn't run the race, so he actually witnessed it, and as did many other members of the Western States Board. And I hope it doesn't happen during my announcing slot. I hope it happens sooner than that. My announcing slot will be from the 24 to 26 hour period. But whenever it happens and Brian crosses that finish line, I think, like to think of 10 years worth of whatever he's had to live with.
Yeah,
Gets put to rest.
Yeah, and he may sneak into that top 10 finish that you're talking about. You're leaving that spot open, right?
He may have that 10th spot.
That might be his. Yeah. How much assistance was there on that track that year? As I remember the story, it was just at the very end, the very finish, or can I recap that?
Again, I wasn't there. I was still out running, unfortunately, yeah. In that insanely hot year of 2006.
Well, since he was in first place.
That's right. Everyone was still out running. Yeah. But from what I understand, he got into the track and he stumbled and fell, sort of on that far turn, and several people kind of came to his assistance and helped him up. And then he made it around, you know, the first 100 meters and the second 100 meters, and then down that stretch, I think he was definitely lilting and needed to be assisted to the extent that the race organizers felt that it was too much assistance to be credited with a finish.
What was the distance for the second place finisher? Would he have time to literally crawl and still have his victory?
Or even lay down for a while?
Yeah, I think Graham Cooper was about 18 minutes behind or 12 minutes behind. He was over 10 minutes behind.
Yeah.
when Brian hit the track.
Gosh. Yeah. Well, that's like you said, there's something to be some unfinished business there, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I would guess there won't be a dry eye in the place when Brian gets to the track.
Well, good.
I know mine won't be dry.
Good. Well, we look forward to the finish. And as promised, let's do an East Coast big race. Let's do something in about Europe this year so that we can get full
coverage.
Yeah, that'd
be great. Yeah. That'd be great.
So we're not so West Coast centric.
Yeah.
So go out and collect some ribbons. That's dumb. Do something better. Scott, you'd make something up. That was weak. Andy, do something
get
decent.
Up your game.
Doggone it.
I didn't get to use my gong.
Oh, gong must there, Scott.
Yeah.
Hang on. I gotta get it up here. We prepared to have the gong because we always have the gong with AJ.
Well, you know, it's part of his contract.
And there you have it. Gong on, everybody.
Gong on.